From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capitol Notes Podcast, our weekly look at California politics and government for the week ending December 11th.
Yeah. Friday the 11th.
Oof. Had to get my dates right there.
It's your weekend Friday?
Yeah, something like that.
No, weekend. Never mind.
Anthony York, the editor of Capitol Weekly, with his homemade brew. No, actually, that sounds like you're drinking alcohol. It's like a mason jar of tea, of hot tea.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's nice.
Would you like some?
It's just quaint. Yeah, it's just quaint. And it's been a cold week here in Sacramento, so it's kind of appropriate. It's been like 10 all week long outside, something to that effect. You'll just let me keep going down this path until I get off of it.
As long as you'd like.
Ah, yes. Before we start, for those of you who listen to us on iTunes, and thank you for listening to us through the iTunes feed.
Yes.
You know, on your touch, on your shuffle, on your iPhone, on your computer. The iPhone feed, the iTunes feed didn't work last week.
What?
Something was screwed up.
Man.
Now, apparently it's because we all had some new gadgets at KQED, and it's really probably my fault.
Steve Jobs sabotage. He's got it out for this podcast ever since that podcast back in February when we...
Roll the tape. No, I'm just kidding. So, obviously if you're hearing us now, then hey, you know, it's working. But if you didn't get one last week... you can listen to it either on Anthony's newspaper's website or my blog. So either kqed.org/capital or capitalweekly.net. Do you have an archive of all of them?
We do.
You do, as do I. On the I should plug the folks at KQED who redesigned the Capitol Notes blog.
It looks very nice.
Last week, so it's slightly more modern than 2004.
Yeah, well.
So there you go. Okay, enough housekeeping. Why don't we talk about politics?
Okay.
Anthony, the man with his finger on the pulse of the Capitol and the race for the next Speaker of the California Assembly.
Yes, an anxious public awaits.
An anxious public awaits.
The results of this exciting election.
All right, this is your story. What's going on? We think this is a done deal, eh?
Yeah, this is getting to be endgame. I mean, the final choreography is kind of being worked out, but there's going to be a vote Thursday when we're recording this. By the time you hear this, there will have been a vote, either only within the Democratic caucus or perhaps on the floor, for a new candidate for Speaker.
Why don't you predict one of them right now, and then people will judge as how good you were with your sources. What do you think will have happened by the time they heard this?
I think that Democrats will have rallied behind John Perez.
But do you think there will be a floor
vote? It will be clear that John Perez will be the next Speaker of the California
State
Assembly.
Come on, go out on a limb, York. Will there be a floor vote on Thursday?
Wherever the vote takes place, there will be a floor.
What a smart aleck. All right, so John Perez has apparently from your sources, we'll talk about how this all went down since we last talked, because, I mean, you know, we were worried when we were talking at the end of last week that the whole Perez De Leon thing would be resolved possibly any time, and it went on for a while.
It
went
did.
On through the weekend, and then you wrote about a big high-powered meeting in Los Angeles at the beginning of the week. Talk
yes,
about it.
Yes, the head of the five families or whatever it was.
It felt like that, right? Reading that, it felt
but
like
that
the Godfather.
You know, but it really is interesting. I mean, this is sort of how Los Angeles politics works. And I don't think Los Angeles is unique in this sense, but especially with term limits and the accelerated cycles of offices opening up and who's going to run for what office – there are people who like to play chess with these offices. And I mean, remember when John Perez was elected back in 2008, he didn't live in the district. I mean, he had to move into the district. And then there were three candidates in the race. Perez was the pick of Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, Perez's cousin, and the LA County Labor Fed. Fabian Nunez, who was then in the assembly, was speaker, well, for a while there. He had his own staffer in the race, Ricardo Lara, who, side note, is actually now running for assembly in Southgate. And Gil Cedillo.
Going to need a flowchart to keep up with
this. Right. But the point being that there were different people had their own candidates in this race, and that in that race, too, there was a big meeting at the home of Antonio Villaraigosa. Fabian Nunez was there. Villaraigosa was there. Maria Elena Durazo, the head of the L.A. County Labor Fed, was there. Gil Cedillo was there. And it was worked out that Perez would run for the seat. Lara would run, in 2010 for this other seat, and that and Laura got an appointment. And
yeah, this was the last meeting,
right?
Let's, so, let's don't lose the podcast here. But
point being that this is often how these things get worked out. So Monday night there was a meeting down in Los Angeles, and with five attendees. It was the mayor, Villaraigosa, the two candidates for speaker, John Perez and Kevin DeLeon, the former speaker, Fabian Nunez, and the current speaker, Karen Bass. And they had gathered. Remember, Bass has been backing Perez for speaker throughout this whole thing. Perez had been a supporter of DeLeon, depending on who you talk to. And
where was Nunez? Nunez is a childhood friend of Kevin DeLeon.
A childhood friend of DeLeon, a strong supporter of DeLeon. Mm-hmm. And Villaraigosa was as well. There was a report that had been going around about a toast on Thanksgiving that the mayor made, saluting, you know, John Perez as the next state senator, which was going to be the plan, and Kevin DeLeon as the next speaker. And then a couple of days later, Perez was a candidate for speaker. So there was a lot of hurt feelings and sort of personal sense of betrayal and a gap of trust that had to be bridged between DeLeon and Perez and their surrogates.
And your sources said the meeting went on for a while, Monday night into Tuesday morning or something, you wrote.
Right.
CapitalWeekly.net, by the way. You can read Anthony's piece.
It's there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's now – and what happened after that meeting, I think, was more indicative of anything. I mean, I don't know how closely you've been covering this, but the reporters who have been covering this have been spun relentlessly by surrogates in both camps. And there was a lot of sort of nasty behind-the-scenes, off-the-record chatter that was being put in the ear of reporters who were covering the story.
I've been waiting for the white smoke. I haven't been covering it that way.
After that meeting, by Tuesday, clearly by Wednesday, that had died down. And so it was clear that some sort of detente was reached. Now, how formal it was and what the ultimate choreography is about whether DeLeon puts his name in for nomination when the Democrats rally today, or whether he announces his support for Perez up front. I mean, that's academic at this point. I think what's clear is that Perez has the votes, has a majority of the caucus, that the caucus is rallying behind John Perez, and Perez will be the next speaker of the California State Assembly.
And this saga that has played out intently, like kind of really white hot intensity over what, 2 weeks or so?
Yeah,
about
2 weeks.
Yeah. We'll finally come to an end here before Christmas, before Hanukkah, before the holidays.
Before Hanukkah.
I threw that in. And we talked about this last week, but the political machinations of LA politics, as you just laid out, are interesting. The political ramifications in the Capitol are interesting. But from a policy perspective, there ain't a lot of difference between John Perez and Kevin DeLeon.
No, I mean, there are some rifts. Perez and DeLeon both have close labor ties. DeLeon's ties with a certain branch of labor, namely the AFL-CIO, has been somewhat strained. Art Pulaski and DeLeon have gotten into it. And some of this is fallout from Nunez. I mean, and fallout from the vote over gaming compacts a couple of years ago. The labor world has gone through its own upheaval over the last few years.
Probably not finished going through it either.
No. It's still going on. Big splits between service employees and the industrial unions. And that's another podcast.
Yes.
But on the major issues, there is not a whole lot of difference between Kevin DeLeon and John Perez. It is sort of a sign, though, of what has happened to the speakership. I mean, a lot of this, remember, this next speaker will preside over the drawing of congressional districts, which is a big, I think, a big consideration. I mean, DeLeon would only be able to be speaker for 2 years. I think there's a reason why people who were backing him wanted him in there for this short amount of time.
Nice transition. By the way, you are now I know why you have the hot tea in here. You're like sick. You don't have H1N1, do you?
No, it's a tickle.
Okay. Well, we'll see how it all plays out. Anthony gave me a perfect transition that he knew he was giving me about redistricting into topic two for this lovely podcast.
Segue and now, us radio people like to
Yeah, you new to radio. Well, you're not really new to it. It's been 3 years we've been doing the podcast, believe
hey,
it or not.
I was the international correspondent for New Zealand Public Radio.
Okay. I'll check out your resume.
Impressive.
So as Anthony was talking about, of course, the legislature will continue to oversee the drawing of maps for Congress after the census in 2010.
Yes.
They will not oversee the drawing of their own districts or the Board of Equalization after Prop 11 passed in 2008. And that was the focus of a piece that I did here on Thursday on the California Report and online, which is that we're about to see the beginning of the process of citizens applying to be on the Independent Redistricting Commission. Be 14 people that'll be on it. The way they are picked is so complicated, I'm not going to mention it on a podcast.
Do you have your application in?
No. No, you, although I think a journalist would be an interesting choice for the commission.
I think I'm ready.
Okay. Well, I'll vote for you or I'll support you. In talking to people about the beginning of the application process, which begins next week, I stumbled across something that I think is noteworthy. Prop 11 allocated $3 million for the entire process, from the selection of members of the commission through the commission's work of drawing the maps for all of those districts through the whole thing. About a three-year process, about $3 million. Well, lo and behold, that the process will have spent almost $2.25 million of that $3 million before the commission is ever selected. Now, that's not to say that the money is being wasted or blown or whatever. You know, that's really not as much of the story as it is a really serious miscalculation as to how much all of this was going to cost, because Prop 11 mandates that there be as much outreach as possible to all communities so that anybody could be on the Citizens Commission, people of all walks of life, all backgrounds, all colors, all, you know, everything. And as a result of that, that takes a lot of outreach. And so Elaine Howell, the state auditor, is the person who is in charge of this process so far. She has asked the legislature to release $2.25 million. In a series of letters late summer, early fall with Denise Duchenne, the state senator from San Diego and who is the chair of the Joint Legislative Budget Committee, Senator Duchenne said, no, $500,000 is all we're going to give you. And so Elaine Howell, the auditor, who has a reputation for being frugal, so it's not mm-hmm. like she has a reputation for spending lots of money, has decided to take money out of her reserve fund to try to pay for the rest of this. What is most of the $2 million going for? Outreach, PR, through a contract with the PR firm Ogilvy. Most of it's for buying radio ads to try to, you know, get the word out about redistricting. A small part, though an interesting part, is supposedly for promoting the redistricting commission process at sporting events. So,
how about a sponsorship on public radio?
Yeah, really. I have a feeling that KQED would probably run PSAs about this, but we don't get paid for them.
Boo,
nonprofit public radio. But I'm not sure sporting events are the right place to get people for a redistricting commission.
I think Raider Nation, you know, some guy in black and silver and black face paint.
I think
with a Gradkowski jersey.
Apparently, most of it would be college sporting events, but nonetheless, I can't quite see that whole connection. But anyway, the bottom line is 75% of the money allocated for this entire process looks that it's going to be spent before the commission ever meets, before the commission hires staff to draw the maps, before the commissioners themselves get paid a stipend to do the work, before the legal challenges, which we know will arise over how these districts are drawn. And the backers of Prop 11, Kathy Fung, a director of Common Cause, who's one of the proponents, said, well, it was a baseline figure based on how much the legislature spent in 2001. Trouble is, the legislature didn't have to hire staff, didn't have to do all the things that an independent commission will have to do.
Well, what's your sense? I mean, is it your sense that this was deliberately lowballed, that the number was deliberately lowballed to make it more palatable politically? Or
I asked that question. And I mean, you know, some people could disagree and would think that if you put a higher number in there, the voters might not have passed Prop 11. Let's not forget, Prop 11 passed really with a razor-thin margin, about 50.9%, I think, of the vote. I think in reality, no one knew what this was going to cost. No one had good data on what all of this would do and what would a statewide outreach be to do all of this.
I think one of those people is probably Elaine Howell. I mean, you've talked to her extensively.
She got thrown this in her lap. They had no idea how to, you know,
It's not like she was sitting there drawing districts before. This was not part of Elaine Howell's job.
So. Brand new function for the state auditor, and having to vet all the candidates who come up, make sure they don't have any problems with the conflict of interest rules in Prop 11. So this is going to be an expensive process, and the legislature has essentially told the auditor, come back to us in 2010, then we'll talk about how much money you need. But, you know, there is an irony that the legislature – many members of the legislature who opposed Prop 11 and losing that power to draw districts are now the ones who have to fund additional dollars to the Independent Commission to do this.
So, I mean, can you foresee a scenario which the money is not released and the commission doesn't have the money to do its job?
I don't think so, because I think the governor is a strong supporter of this. The governor would push it. And again, even if it cost $6 million in the context of a $85, $90 billion state budget process, you know, we're not talking about a lot of money, though, $3 to $6 million for you and me. Lots of cash.
$3 million here, $5 million there.
All right. So sooner or later, it adds up. But this is going to be a complicated process. And I think the bottom line of all of this is no one's done this before. No one knows how this is going to work. You know, we're going to start seeing applications for people next week. It's kind of hard for me to see who wants to be on this commission.
Other than me.
The early word, yeah, except for Anthony. The early word I hear from people is that a lot of localities have had redistricting commissions, a lot of cities, a lot of communities, and people who served on those might be willing to serve on the state commission. But there are very strong conflict of interest disqualifications to be on the commission. Interestingly enough, there are really none for the staff of the commission. And I think that is a real story that has to be followed, because the staff of the redistricting commission will have the expertise on how to draw these maps to make them legal.
So if Michael Berman and Bill Cavalla and other gurus of redistricting,
people who have done it in the past, right, I'm not sure that they would be disqualified from being on the staff. Well,
there you go.
So it's a full employment act. So that was a bit of an interesting element to that as that process begins next week. One of the districts that I think is interesting when you talk about whether redistricting will have an impact whether redistricting really has an impact, and whether you can draw many more competitive districts is a district here outside of Sacramento, an assembly district, Assembly District 5. And it was one that I went and talked to people in a year and a half ago when Prop 11 was on the ballot. It's currently represented by Roger Nilo, Republican from Fair Oaks. Mm-hmm. He's termed out in 2010, and so we have an open seat. And this is going to be a fascinating race, because if you look at the registration numbers, and then, Anthony, talk about the candidates and how it's all shaping out, because you guys wrote about this again this week. But it's about 38% Democrats, about almost 39% Republicans, and 19% declined to state. So this is a true competitive district.
Right.
This on paper would be a district that anyone could win.
And many of those new declined to states have been growing in the district. And excuse me,
you've got a tickle again.
But the decline to state growth has come at the expense of the Republican registration in the district. So Democrats feel like this is a district that they might be able to pick up in a good year. There's a question of what kind of year 2010 will be for Democrats. But a lot of folks in the Assembly Democratic political apparatus think that picking up this district might be a better shot than holding on to some of the other districts, like Allison Huber's district, another Sacramento area district that
8010 in the foothills.
That Huber won by less than 500 votes in what was a big Democratic year in 2008.
And it's going to be a rematch. Her opponent has filed to run for that front of that
Jack
seat again.
Jack Sieglock.
Yeah.
Or even Joan Buchanan's district down AD 15 in the Contra Costa area. So, I mean, there are going to be a lot of competitive races, I think. Remains to be seen whether Democrats actually have the resources and want to dedicate the resources to making a run in 85. But this is a race because of the candidates involved, and one particular candidate, the Republican Andy Pugno, a lawyer who we'll talk about shortly, could get some statewide and perhaps national attention.
Mm-hmm. So Andy Pugno is a Republican. Also, Craig DeLuz is a Republican candidate out of that district. The two Democratic candidates at this point, a new one who entered the race, I think, this week or last week, Matt Gray, who's a lobbyist around the Capitol, is going to run as a Democrat, apparently, and Dr. Ami Berry.
Ami Berry is running for Congress.
Oh, sorry.
Against Dan Lundgren. It's Fred Pan.
Oh, sorry.
Fred? I think his first name is Fred.
I've got my physicians wrong in the Sacramento
area. Dr. Pan.
Okay,
Ami Berry is the candidate in the 3rd Congressional.
My apologies to Dr. Pan. Sorry about that.
But none to you, Dr. Berry.
Okay, but Andy Pugno we need to talk about. Andy Pugno, not just an attorney, but the point man attorney for Prop 8, for the ban on gay marriage.
You know, I think I went to high school with Fred Pan. I'm not sure Dr. Pan's first name is Fred.
Okay. Dr. Pan, we are very sorry. I blame it on Anthony's cold and his hot tea and me just on my stupidity.
Fair enough.
Andy Pugno, Republican candidate for this race, big point man for the Prop 8 legal team for to pass gay marriage, or to ban gay marriage, I should say. So that's going to be an issue in this race, undoubtedly. The folks at the Target Book who look at these districts, I think, have a couple of things about why this district will be fascinating to watch. They say that Prop 8, the ban on gay marriage, passed by about 10 points in that district.
Right.
But they also say Obama killed John McCain in this
literally,
district in 2008.
In that district.
Killed him.
With the candlestick in the conservatory.
Thank you, Colonel Mustard.
Yes.
So that's a split district. I mean, that's a district, you know, again, you know, voting for the big change movement of 2008, but not the change on the social issue. And it is a district that has that looks favorable to Democrats in one way, but the issues are going to matter.
Right.
And I think if you don't live in this area and you're trying to figure out why in the hell we're talking about this for so long, I think this is just another example of how politics is local and how numbers don't always tell the story. And again, this will be a fascinating race to watch for no other reason than Andy Pugno is going to get a lot of attention because of his Prop 8 background.
Well, if Pugno does win the Republican primary, this will become another chapter in the national fight over gay marriage. I mean, I think we've seen some things play out in New York and across the country in recent months and that have sort of gone against gay marriage. And what was seen as an inevitability of the legalization of gay marriage has now been called into question. It remains to be seen how big of an issue Prop 8 and the issue of gay marriage will become. I mean, it'll be unavoidable to some degree if Pugno is the Republican nominee. But there's a quote in the Capital Weekly piece this week written by Malcolm McLaughlin, one of our reporters, I think it's from Pugno saying, I'm not sure 10,000 mercenaries from San Francisco coming in and walking districts in this sort of moderate to conservative district is really going to tip the balance for a Democrat. So, I mean, there are other considerations. And that was really interesting. You know, that quote brought to mind just something that I saw the Barack Obama campaign do in Nevada. When I was there, there were a lot of folks who were coming up from California to walk precincts for Barack Obama. And there was a decided effort to make sure that people did not identify themselves as Californian because there was sort of an anti-California bias in Nevada. There may be an anti-San Francisco, you can't tell us how to run our lives thing that Democrats are worried about in the 5th. So
it'd be an interesting race to watch, especially if you've got the four candidates we're talking about. And again, assuming Pugno got that nomination and then, you know, Matt Gray, the lobbyist and the physician running against him anyway. Well,
and coming full circle, you know, if John Perez is the speaker by then, I think I'll go out on a limb and say he will be. Remember, Perez would if and when he becomes speaker, would be the first gay speaker in state history. And it'll be interesting to see if that's a consideration at all. Yeah. I mean, if that somehow because the speaker controls the resources for the caucus and decides which races the caucus dedicates its money to. And so if, you know, I think that's going to add to some of the drama if you have Pugno as the Republican candidate and then going up sort of, you know, as a proxy against a Democratic party apparatus run by a gay speaker.
Well, in other words, not just the whole machinations over resources, but probably maybe part of the campaign and maybe part of the, you know, if you're looking at that issue in that district, you know, look at the, you know, a openly gay speaker of the California Assembly. We've got to beat that back, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, it could. Yeah. But the potential to get ugly is there.
Potential to get ugly, indeed. Well, we've gone a little while here, but I think there's really not a lot to say about the other big story we're watching, but let's just briefly say there's not a lot to say about the Abel Maldonado lieutenant governor story.
Right.
He still's not lieutenant governor, and we still don't know whether he'll be lieutenant governor.
But we will know by February 22nd.
But we will know by February 22nd, which is when the it's how long the legislature has to confirm or reject. And if they don't do it by then, he automatically gets the job. I just wanted to say quickly that while we didn't get any real sense this week of where the Democrats are lining up on this, there was an interesting I read in the tea leaves bit from Daryl Steinberg, the president pro tem in the Senate this week, who got accosted by a few of us before a different event this week, and we asked him about Maldonado. And he said, and here's paraphrasing him, he said, it's important for us to have a full complement of senators on hand next year to deal with mid-year budget deficit debates and mid-year budget deficit solutions. So what I would read that as, Maldonado, who we need for a budget vote because the other Republicans won't vote for it, needs to be in the Senate to help us solve the current year budget problem next year. Well, which
they,
means
they
which,
better do that before February 22nd.
Yeah, which means to me that then you have a deadline effectively to do that by. By February 22nd, you've got to have a solution to at least the $6 billion problem in the current year. Though remember last year, Arnold Schwarzenegger demanded a solution to the entire budget problem. So maybe you have to have a $20 billion solution by February 22nd.
Perhaps.
Or else, if you don't, the whole thing blows up. Maybe the Dems reject Maldonado. Maldonado will never vote for another budget then. Oh. I mean, who knows? So it's going to be there's going to be a race between when the governor releases that budget in January and the Maldonado clock ticking. That's going to be fascinating to watch.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, all this hemming and hawing over whether Democrats can win that district in a special election if they confirm Maldonado. I mean, the point is, if just from the Senate perspective, the statewide consideration is a different one. But you know, but Sam Blakesley, the Assembly Republican leader, is probably the strongest candidate, Republican or Democrat, for that race now. And the truth is they've got a better shot of getting a vote out of Blakesley than they do out of Maldonado if he's not confirmed. So, I mean, I think if you're trying to count noses for budget votes in the Senate, I think you've got to confirm Maldonado. I mean, that's just the raw politics of it. Whether or not that happens, I think, like you said, will be fascinating to watch.
Yeah, and again, a very small amount of time because the governor releases his budget basically the second week of January every year. And we're talking February 22nd. That's at most 5-6 weeks.
Yep.
So
yep.
Pack a sleeping bag. We're going to be here.
Yeehaw.
And with that, and we'll let Anthony
bring,
rest.
Bring your Twittering device.
Yeah, it did last year. We'll let Anthony rest his tickling throat. And we'll
tickle, tickle.
Say that's the end of this week's Capital Notes podcast. Thanks. We'll see you next time.